Hey, quick note up front of this episode. If you've ever been listening to one of these and thought, huh, I wonder what Soren and Daniel look like when they're doing this podcast. Well, good news. We're going to start doing a video version of the podcast. You can go check that out at YouTube/@QQPodcast, where you can see Daniel and I doing the podcast live. You can see our whole bodies in some of the shots. Some of them are a little tighter, but really just like watch all the ways that we try to find things to do with our hands and our feet and fail. So if that's something that interests you, you can go check it out on YouTube, or you can just listen to those same podcasts as you have been previously. Thank you. And here's the show.
So, hello again and welcome to another episode of Quick Question with Soren and Daniel, the podcast where two best friends and comedy writers ask each other questions and give each other answers. I am one half of that podcast, senior writer for Last Week Tonight, author of How to Fight Presidents, and tire of bow ties, Daniel O'Brien, joined as always by my co-host, Mr. Soren Bowie. Soren, say hello.
Hello, everybody. I'm Soren Bowie. I'm a writer for American Dad and a bit of a tire myself, period. Just like a, I've gotten a little rounder in the midsection since I haven't been able to work out.
I brought up bow ties. A few weeks ago, you were absent from this podcast, and I introduced myself as a tire of bow ties to our fill-in hosts, Michael Swaim and Abe Everson, and neither of them asked me any follow-up details about being able to tie a bow tie. And I realized I rely on you to pick up on whatever I'm dropping and ask me about it. And they just didn't.
I am actually very curious because you took me to the Emmys once on a date. Yeah. And when we went, I considered the possibility of buying a bow tie that was, you know, like at the end of the night, you see it kind of dangling at the, like somebody's done with, and like they don't unclip it. They untie it.
No, yeah, they call that raw.
And I thought, oh, maybe I'd be the type of person who could just wear like a real bow tie. And is it a humiliation not to? And then as soon as I was at a rental place and they're telling me how you tie one, I was like, oh, no, this is beyond my means.
Okay, so this is fascinating. So you have never tied a bow tie before?
Not once in my life.
Wow, okay. So this, oh boy, it ties into what I want to talk about. As my quick question for you, which is, hey, Soren, quick question.
Okay.
What are assumptions people have had about you that have surprised you? And I'm gonna, I'll bring it all the way around. The first, the reason this comes to mind is I had a wedding a couple weeks ago, and I was in the bridal party. And the groom leading into the wedding was like, everyone get ready at your hotel rooms and then we'll meet at the suite the morning of the wedding to distribute bow ties and pocket squares. And everyone can, we'll all tie our bow ties together. And he said his best man he knew could tie bow ties. And he said, Daniel, I don't know this for sure, but I assume you can tie a bow tie. And I thought, that is one of the most flattering things anyone has ever said to me. I cannot tie a bow tie, but I really love the expectation, the assumption that I could. And I was in, but before we get into the further assumptions part of this episode, I gotta say, I was in a really bad place trying to learn how to tie this bow tie. I was very, we were all together sweating and watching YouTube videos.
So you didn't, like, you didn't get it beforehand and be like, days leading up, be like, well, I should probably learn this. You're just like, on the day, you're like, I'll figure it out on the day.
Yeah, because it's like a group activity. You know, we're all together trying to learn bow ties, and I really lost my cool. And I thought I had aged out of this level of anger in my soul, or sure. Like
Daniel O'Brien.
Yeah, yeah. Or I thought I meditated it away. But an hour and a half of struggling to tie a bow tie, I entered into a realm of rage and disquiet that was, I was not good to be around. None of us were, but I really felt it with me, and I was unreasonable. I kept like pacing around the suite, not tying this bow tie, and repeating, "I don't know about this. I don't know, guys."
The most destructive thing you can be saying.
I'll keep trying it, but I don't know.
Yeah.
What if I can't do it? And then what's plan B? We should have, I'm going to keep trying, but what's plan B? We should have a second plan in case we need to prepare for a future where I don't tie this bow tie and I, in fact, rip it to shreds.
So you were, this is what I'm picturing. Tell me this is right. You're trying. Mm-hmm. You get it wrong again. Like, let's say like for the sixth time, you like take it off and then you take a lap.
Yeah. I was going to ask, have you ever done that? We'd watch these videos, which by the way, if you've ever looked at a YouTube video on how to tie a bow tie, every single one of them is fucking infuriating. It's some dork loser magician asshole who is, taking his sweet ass time for the first step, and the first step is like a long introduction on the birth of bow ties, and the second step is like hang it over your neck and let's talk about necks for a second, and then the third step is like dangle the long part over the right side, and then the fourth step is make a bow tie real quick.
Yeah. No, I'm familiar. I'm building furniture. I found the same thing where people are, I'm like origami with my son, where I'll be like, I'm like, all right. He's like, well, I want to learn how to make one of those birds. And I'm like, okay, you mean a crane? We can do that. Sure, that should be easy. Or like even paper airplanes. And we'll like get in there like, let's go over the history of planes in general. The Wright brothers on Kitty Hawk or like Kill Devil Hill, like when they figured out how to fly a plane. And like, thinking about thrust and things like that. And I was like, okay, let's just scan ahead. Oh, we're too deep. I have no idea how to do any of this. And then I'll go back. And still, like everything that I missed anyway. Like I watching it, I'm like, I don't, what the fuck did he just do? There's like a double fold he just did.
Yeah. It's very frustrating. And I want to find a YouTube video for a bow tie with a guy that looks like me and is like, who starts off and is like, I hate this too. I hate fucking doing this. I'll go slow at the normal parts and fast at the who cares parts. But we didn't have that, and I kept switching from different YouTube magician to different YouTube magician. And every time I got close and couldn't do a bow tie to completion, I would just be like, that's it, I'm taking a lap. And I would wander around. Like, there's nothing to do and nowhere to go, but I couldn't try again. I needed some time to myself.
No, some time to just like bring down the energy of the group. Yeah. You walked around and mentally sabotaged everyone around you.
Yeah,
with this
prospect for sure.
This might not ever happen for any of us.
No,
and we have to live with that. We have to come up with a like a worst case scenario situation.
Eventually, I got it, and we all did. We all figured it out eventually. And then the photographers came into the room to take pictures of us getting ready, and we were all like red faced and sweaty. And we're like, no one is undoing their ties. You're not going to get any pictures of us doing ties together. This is it. None of us are taking our ties off until we fucking die.
Yeah. I'll tell you what. I'll unbutton the bottom of my shirt and you can get me doing that. Well, shit. I'm sorry that happened. I can't imagine. When I watched the guy at the what was it called? The tuck shop or whatever. What is that fucking place? He was... Watching him do it, I was like, oh, no, that's not for me. My hands don't operate like that.
It's one of the steps in every bow tie video you'll see is one of these magicians saying, make a bow tie shape, which is an absurd thing to be part of this process.
What an asshole.
But now I can tie one, and now I'm looking for more and more opportunities to to do it, which are few and far between.
Right. Don't lose it, obviously. Yeah. You got to hold on to it. Do you still have the actual bow tie?
I do, yeah.
I mean, this is it's a little dark. Are you sitting alone at home at night tying the bow tie just to remember how to do it, I feel like is a valuable skill to have.
Is it less dark if I told you I did that exact same scenario, but in the daytime? Is that better? Day after the wedding, I sent a picture to my group chat of me in a t-shirt with a fully tied bow tie being like, I got it now.
I'm like crunching the numbers in my head. I guess it depends on if it was raining.
It was a sunny, beautiful day.
That's worse. That's because you could have been outside. Yeah. That's good, though. I think it's important. I still do that with climbing rope.
Yeah.
There's like a butterfly fold that you're supposed to do with climbing rope to like pack it. And it's endlessly annoying because when somebody shows you how to do it, they're already practiced at it. Like practiced hands, watching practiced hands do something that you're learning is infuriating. I think it must be so frustrating to be a child because you see that constantly where someone's just like, just draw a cat. Yeah. And they show you and you're like, well, hold on. How is your circle so good to start? but like watching people fold a climbing rope, it's super important because you can fray the rope really easily. You can do damage to it and it's got to be right. You don't want any knots in it. And somebody doing it, you're like, oh, that looks easy. And then you try it and you're like, that's really hard. And yeah. So I used to just sit there while I was watching like Frasier or whatever. And I would just butterfly fold climbing rope.
I certainly felt that in first grade when you talk about kids learning things. And there's that a version of a star that you can draw where your pencil never leaves the page. And you just like do like one consecutive line to make a crisscross star. I went to a Catholic kindergarten where we didn't learn how to do that. And so when I went to secular first grade, everyone knew how to do it except me. And no one seemed to know how to teach it to me. It was just like a thing that they all, and they'd forgotten that they learned it. It seemed like they were all born with it. And they were like, oh, just do like a star. And I was like, but I can't because God didn't know. So I guess I'm not allowed to know. And I felt so behind.
I see it in my son too. Like when he's something that I just assume is a priori and like watching him try to then do it and getting like that look of helplessness in his face because he doesn't know how to articulate like I can't do it like you. He's just all of a sudden he's like, oh, I'm not meant for this.
Do you practice origami without him? Are you like really great at doing a crane now?
I should. No. In fact, every time that I do it, it leaves my head immediately. Like we figured out how to make these really kick-ass airplanes. I couldn't even tell you the first step anymore. At each stage, I learn it just for him and then it's gone.
Is he into Legos at all?
Loves them. Loves Legos. And he's so good at them. I've got a rule follower. That awesome. Comes from both of us, both Colleen and I. But the idea of having instructions in front of him and the idea of going through each step one by one by one is so enticing and like scratches this special itch in his brain that he is into it. And he's like, I don't need to help him.
That's cool. But anyway, the reason I wanted to ask you about assumptions, this came up recently. I was protesting a few weeks ago with my coworkers, Sophia and Liz. We are listeners. Strike update. We're protesting because the studios are not giving writers a fair contract for the work that we do to make the studios billions of dollars every single year. So we're protesting a lot. You'll see us out on these streets whenever we can. And I was catching up with some coworkers, and my coworker Sophia brought up two assumptions that she had of me organically. One of them, she assumed I had been a Boy Scout, and she also assumed that I don't like or never had sushi. And I am
scathing, dude.
I know it's real bad. It's rough. I was so fascinated by these assumptions, and I was like, "What else do you think about? Like, what do you mean?" Because it seemed like she had broadly constructed a version of me that was all-American boy, which could be very insulting, depending on so many things, depending on many things. The sushi thing in particular was like, I'm a worldly person. I've had sushi. I like sushi. I can tell you where the bad sushi is.
That one's the worst. I mean, being a Boy Scout, I guess, could go either way. I mean, people say, call other people Boy Scouts pejoratively, right?
Like, yes,
oh, look 100%. At you, fucking Boy Scout.
Yeah. And Boy
we
Scout,
don't do that to
I think was born out of like, because I was talking to her about bow ties and how I couldn't tie one. And she assumed I was good with knots because she thought I was a Boy Scout.
Yeah.
And I was like, no, but what do you mean?
Also, Boy Scouts aren't out there like tying bow ties into
no
rope hitches and stuff.
And through this conversation, we talked to another coworker of mine who, in like a comedy riff, was talking about me hanging out with my buddies. And she's like, yeah, you and your buddies, Frank and Joe and Mike and Bob and Bob. And then she paused and she was like, that's what I think all of your friends' names are. But I just realized, because it's all very all-American. But I realized I've only met one of your friends before, and his name was Soren. And I was like, yes, thank you. My friends are diverse and interesting.
Where is she from? Where's Sophia from?
Sophia? Fucking Pennsylvania.
Why is she? That's like more American. God damn it. She has no right. But that is very funny. It is very funny that when when you realize who you are in somebody else's head. The one that I get a lot is people assume that I have some history with sailing.
Oh.
And I don't know why. Because like people who know also that I grew up in Colorado, and I'll be like, why would you think that I know how to sail? And like, there's lots of places to sail. You can sail on lakes and stuff. And I'm like, well, I didn't know that. I don't know anything about sailing. I don't know the first fucking thing about sailing.
Yeah.
And I don't know what it is. It's like blonde hair, I think. Or I used to wear polo shirts, and maybe that those two things in combination was enough that people were like, he's nautical.
Yeah. It does make me want to know what everyone assumes about me. Like this is – so you and I were both at a wedding last week for our dear, beloved, sweet, sweet former coworker, Michael Swaim. And we were in the bridal party, and he gave us each amazing groomsmen gifts, these little how would you describe them? Tokens? Totems?
I would describe them as
game piece?
Yeah, like a game piece.
Yeah. If we were playing a board game, this would be the
1-inch
tall avatar of me in the game. And each avatar is custom designed by Michael, and they're meant to represent each person in the bridal party. It was very sweet, very moving. They're all like animal human hybrids with a bunch of artifacts and tools with them, and every detail in the design speaks to something that Michael put thought into and speaks to what he thinks of us as men and as people in his party. It was very
who
moving.
We are to him.
Yeah. And he went through and with each of us was like, I created this character for you because it represents XYZ. It has these tools because they remind me of you. And it was really flattering, really sweet, but it also scratched the worst part of my ego, which is like, oh, now I want everyone in the world to tell me what they think I'm like. Michael thinks I'm a strong frog who fishes and works out a lot and hikes and is outdoorsy. Now someone else, like Soren, what do you think of me? Brendan, what do you think of me? Cody, now you go. Now you, what animal would you make me? Because
there was one in there that there's something that your frog has on it that he's like, this is because I think you're the strongest writer of all of us.
I wasn't teeing you up to.
But I'm trying to remember what that thing was. What was it?
It's a unicorn horn.
Oh, right. You're the unicorn.
Yeah.
You're a unicorn within the group. You're the strongest writer of it. Yeah.
Which I don't think entirely earned, but it was very flattering to hear, especially from Michael. But again, ego monster that I am, I'm just like, I would like everyone to tell me what they think I'm like, because he thinks I'm like fucking fit and outdoorsy and a really good writer, which is very nice to hear. I would like other people to say very nice things.
Well, the other thing is that he was also willing to be like, he's willing to say things that weren't necessarily like completely, he wasn't gassing everybody up.
No.
There's elements of each one of those. It's like, and you've got like this thing, and like it's kind of a flaw, but it's a thing I love about you. Like yeah. There's some of those in there, which I thought was really great. So that it's not just all like ego boosting. It's like, no, this is genuinely how I see it. Like he gave me a rapier. And he's like, because I think that occasionally you may not even be aware of it, but you will say one little thing and it will cut somebody down.
Yeah. He gave like, me a side piece. Like I've got a gun holster because he was like, I don't think of you as a cop, but I think of you as very protective. And I'm like, no, this is a cop. This is a unicorn frog cop.
So the one that he gave me was a jackrabbit. Yeah. With a mohawk, and he's like, and he said, because I feel like jackrabbits are just like the sexiest of creatures, and I was like, well, hold on, now I have a bunch of questions. No, because is that true? They've got those big translucent veiny ears. They're trembling all the time. I was like, let's really think through. Like horse haunches, very sexy. Can we start there?
Yeah. I like your decision to give him notes on the creation of your character.
Did I do that?
No.
Oh, you're just doing now. It now.
Yeah.
No. Well, I was like that because to him, jackrabbit. He's like, it's like the sexiest of creatures. And I was like, in the room, I definitely took that compliment. I was like, looked at everybody else, like, did you hear that? but then I thought about it. And I was like, what? Jackrabbits are sexy, huh?
Yeah.
To Michael, interesting.
It would be an incredible bit on his part that he wouldn't do because he's got such a big heart and he's so loving. If he gave all of us these detailed characters and then like, and Cody, you are the thimble because you're useful and people like you. I don't know.
Oh, that's a great bit. God, he could have done that because I was in the bridal party late. Like it would have been very funny for him to have gone through everybody and then given me the car from Monopoly. Yeah. And then like tried to do it.
Because you're so fast and safe if you're wearing a seatbelt.
But he put, it's incredible. He put so much thought into every single deal. And there's like, it's just littered with metaphors, each one of them. And so it was great to hear him go through each one for every person because it was like, Jesus, like there's a story for every one of these. Yeah. It's incredible. That's probably the best bridal party gift I've ever gotten.
Did you give gifts at your wedding for your bridal party?
Yes.
You had a smallish bridal party, no?
It was small. I think I gave them the ties that they wore for the wedding and maybe some like tie clips and cufflinks or something like that. Mm-hmm. Something that was specific to the wedding. And then Colleen gave her wedding party these gold-plated aspen leaf earrings that were really cool that they all wore for the wedding. It was stuff for the wedding.
Yeah. But now they have forever.
Right.
It's cool. It's the other amazing thing that Michael did for us is on their wedding website,
oh my God.
They introduced the bridal party and he wrote like full on paragraphs about every single member of his bridal party. That was so sweet and moving and also made me just think like, why can't we talk to each other like this all the time? Why can't we just say nice things to each other? Why do they have to wait for Michael to get married to learn all these nice things he has to say about it, me and Soren and Cody and Abe and et cetera.
Yeah, it was really, like humbling. He was like, he had written just like vows for each of us, basically. Yeah. Like they were really beautiful and kind. And just getting that, I was like, Michael, this is like one of the best things I've ever had as a groomsman. And he's like, no, man, there's more.
Yeah.
Just wait. So metaphors mean a lot to him. I'm really happy about that because they mean a lot to me too. And he knocked it out of the park.
Yeah.
Sailing's mine.
Sailing. Got it. Yeah.
I don't know why.
I think I assumed about you, but I don't know if I ever asked you, lacrosse?
That's another one. God,
is that
I
one?
Was, yeah. That's another one that I get a lot. I've never played lacrosse in my life.
Okay.
I understand how the game goes and I understand like cradling and stuff like that, but I have never in my life played a game of it.
I don't think we even had lacrosse. Like, I don't think the sport of lacrosse had reached my dirt corner of New Jersey growing up. but I dimly understood it as like, oh yeah, if your parents made a little bit more money, we would tell you about lacrosse. And so when I met you and I saw your blonde hair and how fit you were, I was like, oh yeah, lacrosse for sure.
Yeah, that I think I told you this story before, but when I worked out in Santa Monica, there was a woman at the gym who was like watching me one day, and then she came over and she's like, you play lacrosse, don't you? I was like, no. No, I don't.
Well, shit, that was my way in to flirting
yeah,
with you.
That was my only thing, yeah. Oh, I really go for lacrosse players. I'm so sorry to have bothered you.
No, I don't play lacrosse. I'm a writer. Oh, well, that doesn't fit.
It's so funny that you say that lacrosse didn't make it to New Jersey yet. Because like lacrosse is like the sport that predates all of us being here.
That's right. It's an indigenous Native American sport, correct?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And then it did turn like some, it got co-opted and reappropriated and it became rich boy sport.
Yeah. But you never played. That's so.
No, never played in my life. I've never played. There's a lot of games that I like. I'm realizing now that I've never played because my son shows an interest in things where I'm like, oh fuck, I don't think I can help you there. Like tennis. He was like interested in tennis. And I was like, buddy, this is the wrong guy for that job. I don't think I can help you.
But I'm sure you will. I mean, like we were not a family that played soccer at all. We were in Little League, my brothers and I, baseball. Mm-hmm. And basketball, and we played like O'Brien football every Sunday, just my brothers and my dad and me. And like soccer was not on our radar whatsoever. We didn't play it. We were not interested in it and didn't watch it. And now my brother David is like the co-coach of his kids' soccer league.
Oh, wow.
You just have to do it, I guess. Like you,
yeah,
as the origami coach for your son.
I guess that's probably true. It's very easy to, at that age, to know more about the sport than the kids.
Yeah.
Like your knowledge will surpass anything that they will get to throughout that season. So that makes sense.
Yeah.
You're not fucking them up yet. You're not. I actually am. That reminds me, Dan. I have a quick question for you.
Oh, good. Yeah.
When you played family football.
Yeah.
Which I think is like a pretty universal, well, I guess it's an Americana thing. Within the United States, people play within their family American football. And I would say it generally happens during halftime during football games. Mm-hmm. When you're like watching football on TV and then at halftime, everyone's like, well, let's go outside and play football. What was the breakdown of like how you guys played? Because you have a family of four where you got like your dad and then two brothers.
Yeah.
So what are teams? Like what is the dynamic?
Me and Dad versus Tommy and David, my two older brothers. And
okay.
We didn't do it at halftime. We didn't watch a whole lot of football together. But Sundays after church, we would go to the school down the street from where we grew up and just like take over that field and play two-on-two football. We did flag football where we had like an old, I can't remember if it was a curtain or a bed sheet that we'd ripped to shreds and became the flags that we tucked into the back of our pants. And we would just play two on two and stealing each other's flags instead of tackling. And towards the end of our time doing this, my dad built a little wooden trophy that would get handed back and forth depending on who won that week.
Where did your brothers and you... Did you ever cry during it? Like if you didn't do well, did you get super frustrated?
No, weirdly, because I was an emotional kid, but we didn't, I think just the energy of the sport burrowed deep into my heart that I understood, like sometimes you win, sometimes you lose. And it's the love of the game, I guess.
That's great.
And it was so much more fun for me than Little League baseball and basketball. I fucking hate it, but playing football 2-on-2 with my family was fun.
Yeah, because the expectations are different.
Yeah.
Everyone's playing for fun, as opposed to some kids are like, this is going to be my career.
Yeah.
Okay. So I had my brother and I and then my dad, and it's a very different, the game has to move differently, obviously. The way that it works is we would play, we'd rotate out who was on whose team, and you individually were scoring points, and whoever had the most points at the end won.
Okay.
So like two people are on offense, one person is on defense, and that person on defense is just in coverage, right? They're not like sacking the quarterback or anything. Their job is to just cover whoever's out there trying to catch the ball. If they make that catch, there's no tagging either. You just stop where you are and you move to that point. Oh. And you're like trying to get up the field. And by the way, this is on like a 45 degree stone. There's just like gravel driveway.
Yeah.
That we're playing down into the garage. And if you get into the garage, you win. Or you get a point, and then you go back up to the top and you cycle through who's on whose team again. And because you have
it's very funny that like you talk about not being able to sack the quarterback. There's no strategy at all in these early games. It's really just like who is faster than the other sibling.
Right.
That's what I came down to for us. There's no outthinking at all. It was just like, I'm the fastest. And then next year, my brother hits a growth spurt. And it's like, well, that's the fucking game. I'm done. I can't. I'm cooked.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. So it was a lot of like, and my brother and I, just because I was the younger sibling, I advanced a lot faster because that's just what younger siblings do because they have to keep up.
Yeah.
And so it became like a real competition where I was very serious about it. And when I would lose, I had a hard time emotionally dealing with that. Cause certainly throughout the game, like there'd be something where like you got bumped or you felt it wasn't fair. And so I would sit out, like the game would end. And if I didn't win, I would just stay out there and or like walk into the woods and I would just cry.
Man.
But yeah. I am actually really happy that my dad just gave me the space to do that he wasn't like, hey, come here, let's talk about it. That he was like, all right, fucking, if you're not happy, go deal with it.
But it wasn't coming from them though. It wasn't like you gotta go and no. Be sad. Because
it was my own like I wanted to win so bad when I was a little kid. And when I wasn't winning and I felt that even the slightest bit of it was unfair, or even that like, yeah, my brother was bigger than me and he could muscle me out and stuff, I would get so I feel so helpless and frustrated that I would just walk into the woods and cry.
Yeah. It reminds me very tragically of a kid I grew up with down the street from me, this kid, Chad, who was a big soccer head. And when he would lose in soccer, you could see him running miles down the block with tears in his eyes. He was just like self-punish or self-betterment, whatever you want to call it, which is like sprinting for hours after a soccer loss.
Yeah, that was his penance.
Yeah, yeah.
to run home. Yeah, it was, I just couldn't deal with it.
And then I sat on my front porch reading books, just like, just don't play soccer, and then you'll never have to do this. You'll never have
practicing
to do it again.
The clarinet out on your porch. Oh, he looks really mad. I'm the duck or whatever in Peter and the Wolf. Sure. Okay, that's good to know. And then I think there's like because there's got to be I've played alone with my dad too when I was little. If like my brother didn't want to play with us, and like the game has to fundamentally change, and there's like different ways you can play football with the very like a certain number of people that I think everybody knows. Do you know how you play with two people?
I don't remember at this point. No,
it is the same way where you have a certain distance you got to go. You come up with plays beforehand. You got to run the play exactly. And if you catch the ball, wherever you catch it, you stop right there. You move up to that point and then you keep going. There's no first downs or anything, but you got to like get to the end zone in a certain amount of drives or else like it starts over.
Yeah. That makes sense. That's familiar. I remember how excited I was when knockout, a variation of basketball, was introduced to my life.
Yeah.
You played knockout. I assume most of our audience has played knockout or horse is another example of like a basketball adjacent game that you could play because that like very early on lit my fuse for me as like, good. I don't want to play like competitive basketball. I like a fun one at a time version of basketball where we're all having a good time and I'm not like sprinting up and down the court against my friends or family.
Yeah, absolutely.
Horse was fucking great. Inventing fun shots and silly shots to try to get other people to do was like, yeah, this is more sports should be about creativity than athleticism.
Rhoda and I play horse. Well, we play a version of horse where he has to spell horse and I have to spell pig.
Uh-huh.
Because like it's just not fair yet.
Yeah. Because so. His vocabulary is much better than yours.
And then we play a lot of board games. We were playing Sorry. Are you familiar with Sorry?
I'm certain I've played it before, but it's one of those.
It's a lot of just fucking over the other person. It's a board game where you have four pieces, and you're trying to get yours all the way around the board and into a safe zone. There's cards.
The one where there's the dice exists in a half bubble in the middle of the thing?
No.
Ah.
That is not Sorry. That is...
What am I talking about?
I know exactly what you're talking about. Fucking hold on.
Do we do games like that anymore? What an exciting time that was.
That's called Trouble.
Trouble! Yeah.
Yeah. This one is just cards. But the cards have like different rules on them. And a big part of the game is just trying to screw over the other person. So much of it is defense. And Ronan and I invented like a new way of playing where you're playing some of the other pieces as just defensive pieces. And it's legitimately fun for me. Like I get excited when I'm like, he comes home from school and I'm like, yes, okay, we can play Sorry. And he's like, just give me a second. Like, let me get a snack. Let me wash my hands. Yeah. No, take your time. But like, I got it all set up. I got the board set up.
Yeah.
Do you want to do like three defensive pieces or one?
Look, Dad, you're clearly revved up, but like, I haven't even had my fucking banana yet. So just
cool it. Dad, I gotta make dinner. I have to go get Gilly. Then maybe we can play before, and then I'll read you a story and we'll go to bed. Yeah,
Ronan,
it's like
Ronan, let's play a game. Did you wash your hands? Sorry.
Hold on. Yeah, it's legitimately fun. It's the same with like Guess Who, where he and I created the version where you have to say, I guess it was Colleen and I that created it, but it was you could ask. Only questions that could be like rhetorical type of questions. Like you could be like, but it's not rhetorical, is not even the right word. It's just like, does your person have a timeshare?
Yeah.
You'd have to be like, yes. They'd be like, okay. And then just based on how everybody looked, you would put down.
Like pure vibe questions. I think someone on Twitter was like, you should play Guess Who, where it's like, does your person fuck?
Yeah.
And it's like, no.
Yeah, does your person own a gun?
No, Richard doesn't. Yeah, Richard does not fuck.
Yeah. All right. Well, Dan, I have a question for you.
Oh, my God. Is the show still happening?
Yeah, it's still going on.
Sure.
I think this might be actually really helpful. A lot of the questions that I hear from people like about writers is like, how big is the room that you're in? They don't understand the idea of mini rooms. They're like, oh, some of my favorite shows are written by people who... wrote by themselves, like Mike White wrote White Lotus all by himself.
Yeah.
Sometimes it seems like it's better if you have smaller rooms and people they don't like understand.
Like very funny, people have been saying that like, oh, rooms where a show is written entirely by one person, like Mike White writing White Lotus, end of list.
Well, Aaron Sorkin, I think maybe writing some seasons of West Wing.
Sure.
Or the first season of... True Detective, and they're like, is his name Mike Pizzolatto? Is that his name?
Yeah, Pizza
Coffee. Okay, Pizzolatto.
Pizza Coffee, yeah.
Pizza Coffee.
Nick Pizza Coffee.
Nick Pizzolatto, that's right.
Yeah.
And they're like, I think it's probably better to have smaller rooms. You can't force a big room. Like, how big is your room? And I'll be like, oh, it's 16 people. And they're like, that's way too big. And I don't think people will totally understand like that not all those people are writing together. And so I thought it would be helpful to explain to people how a room actually works, like what happens in a room. I think that would be good to like kind of like explain how the sausage is made. Is that all right with you?
Yeah, sure.
I'll tell you mine first. It's we have about 16 people, 16 writers. Those writers are break up into three smaller groups, and then each of those rooms is doing something different. sometimes two of them are breaking a story together for one person. That person will go off and write. But other times that room is like doing a rewrite on another script, because there's a lot of overlap between scripts that are already done in different stages in the process, and then other ones that are just getting written, or you're just breaking the story. And then what always happens with like a story that's being rewritten is then you also have a joke room, because the story like is taking up so much of the time that you don't want to just sit there on a joke for 45 minutes that's just not working. You like send it to another room and they give you 15 versions of it, and you can be like, oh yeah, great, we'll take this one. And so at any given moment, like, everybody's working on different things. And then you also have your own episodes throughout the season that you're leaving the rooms to go do. You're off on like doing records, listening to like other people do the voices for the show. In my case, on a live action, you'd be on set and you'd be working there for the day. So you're not even in the room. And so there's like, even if you have for a 22 episode season, 16 people is not a ton. It's like, it really thins out pretty fast. And if you tried to do it with like 10 people, it would be highly stressful. So with mini rooms, like the problem that everyone's complaining about with mini rooms is that it's, you've got like six people and their job is to break a story, break a series from scratch, yeah. Basically. They're not only rewriting the pilot that got sold, so that it can be the very first episode. They're building the arc of the seasons. They've got to decide on what, they're not just doing like these little bottle episodes. There has to be like it has to be serial. Like one episode depends on the next. And so they're building these emotional arcs throughout the seasons, as well as like a three act episode-y every single episode. And then they're also doing all of that other stuff that I was describing, like rewrites, right, and stuff like that. And that's just like, it's such a small group that it's untenable for them, and they have to do it in like 6 weeks. It's nothing. Yeah.
And when we're talking about these mini rooms, it's again like Soren's saying, not like you're not doing standalone bottle episodes. You are six people writing a season of Bridgerton, for example, a very like involved, interconnected show where it's not just like, you can't just, oh, it's my Bridgerton episode, so in this one, the main character, Emily Bridgerton, rides a submarine and makes friends with a mermaid. No, you're still like, you have to connect to the larger plot of Bridgerton. I'm going to stop right now and say, I don't know why I picked Bridgerton, a show I've never seen.
Because it does feel very heavy. It feels like it's very plotty that like you'd have to work at it.
Yeah.
But I think you're absolutely right.
It seems really intricate.
Yeah, absolutely.
In my imagination.
And so it's you got this like impossible job for these people in these small rooms to do.
Yeah.
But I wanted to give like a breakdown of how our room works, because I think people would be interested to even hear that, I assume. Yeah. But it's you have three different groups and all of them are working separately. And occasionally throughout the year, like those groups will get mixed up, but you have your core group and you are breaking a story for basically everybody in that group throughout the season, in addition to rewrites and jokes and anything else that needs to be done along the way that like comes and interrupts the breakings.
So do you get your room assigned at the beginning of the year or season, or do you pick your room? Okay.
No, gets assigned by the EPs, the executive producers pick it, and they basically, they don't say this, but they're trying to make it even. They're trying to make sure that every room is balanced. Mm-hmm. You've got like good strengths from every position there, so that
that would
room...
put me so fucking deeply in my head look around my room. That's an extra layer of torture that I don't need in a job, honestly, to look around and try to figure out, am I the ringer or am I the dead weight?
Trying to figure out if you're like a journeyman, it's like, it's rough, man. If you're just like a utility player, you're like, all right, that's fine. What is the utility you want me to do? Surely you think I have a strength. I'll just do that. That's fine. I spin out on it every single time.
Like if I got a room and was like, man, it's three legends. Oh, wait, no, it can't be. It's two legends and me. Oh no.
And then our boss knows all that, and will say things just to get under everybody's skin. Like he'll like he'll see the rooms and he'd be like, oh, two of these rooms are really great. Then you have to be like, oh man, okay, all right. Never gonna say which ones. That's fine. Yeah. That's fine. Probably didn't even believe that. Just wanted to hurt me. But yeah, we break up into those rooms, and then like throughout an ordinary day, you're only working on one thing. If you're working on breaking a story for somebody in that room, and breaking a story just means that somebody comes in, they have an idea, a very broad strokes idea for what they want an episode to be, and then you're deciding on what the scenes are and what the acts are and the act breaks that make it all make sense into like a really good, not only like plot of a story, but also like you want a good emotional arc so that a character is learning something throughout the episode.
Yeah.
Right. And so then when you're deciding that together, really the person whose episode it is kind of like leading the room. Occasionally an executive producer who's there will also, if they feel like it's steering in the wrong direction, they'll like bring it back. Like for instance, I was doing an episode about, Trish and Suze, who are on the show called Morning Mimosa in our world. And I was like, it would be really cool if they were like an Elvis situation where we find out that they're just trapped there, that they are drugged up each episode. Like they're on the ground before the episode and somebody's standing over the producer standing over them being like, nothing else matters except that we get them on stage in the next 30 seconds. And yeah. And I was very excited about that. And it wasn't until like a week into breaking that they're like, it feels a little dark. Like it feels like maybe we're like, that gets a little sad. And it's really that we've had essentially what is these kidnapped women. Yeah. And I was like, oh, that's totally true. Absolutely.
It's so funny how different our shows are that seems a little too sad is never going to be a criticism that stops us from making an episode of Last Week Tonight.
It's supposed to be, in fact,
like that's the start of the pitch. Like, this is really sad. Women forced into slavery on television. It's like, yeah, greenlit. Straight to prompter. Let's go.
All right, make it funny. Yeah, so tell me, like, how does your room work?
Our room is a little bit different than yours because we're not so narrative, obviously. There's, in my time at Last Week Tonight, our room has been as large as 13 people and as small as 6 people. And 6 people was easily one of the lowest points of my professional career because of the amount of work that we all had to do was just like punishing. Typically, it's a little bit similar to yours in that there's different things that you're doing throughout the year. You break off into groups of 2 or 3 writers per story, per episode, where we're doing the main story, whatever it is. And if you're not assigned to a main story, then you'll be on the top of show, which is the beginning of the show where it's like, just a quick recap of the week. Here's 6 to 8 minutes on whatever happened this week with some jokes. Then we get into the main story. And if you're not on either of those, then you are pitching constantly. And all of us, depending on who's available, get in to do just jokes. Like the same as your room where it's like, hey, there are a couple of holes in the script that need jokes. So we're going to get every available writer together to gang on these setups and write as many punchlines as we can.
Right.
When we were... So we read and rehearse every episode 2 or 3 times a week before it actually airs. And if you didn't write that episode, then you will be called in to be fresh eyes, to just sit in on the rehearsal and take in the script for the first time and give your notes as essentially like an audience member. Like, here's what didn't make sense to me. Here's what I think could be cut from this episode. It's a very helpful thing because when I'm working on an episode, I know it forwards and backwards, inside and out, and the same as the other writers who were on that episode, and it all seems essential. And it all seems very familiar to you. It's incredibly helpful for a new person to come in and be like, I don't know why this clip is in here, or I don't know why this point is in here. Yeah. Because as the writers were like, it's in there because I learned it, so now you have to fucking learn it. I don't know.
Yeah.
But they come in like, no, I'm an audience member, and like, this is not useful information for me to digest this story.
Yeah, we have a little bit of that in our story rooms where there's, as we're like, because somebody will bring a script back in, that's the writer's draft, and then we do a rewrite on the writer's draft before the table read. And so a lot of times during that, you start to like, you have no idea what your script is anymore. You cannot look at it objectively. Yeah. You've just brought in this very vulnerable thing. And then you're like, is this, am I still good at this? And you show it to everyone and they're like, yeah, wait, but why is this? Like, what is this scene? And you're like,
it's a month of my life, you asshole.
Yeah. Oh yeah. I mean, that scene, fuck that scene.
But when we were a writing team of six people, I was friend of the show, friend of ours, Caitlin Large, was staying with me in New York at the time when one of my bosses, my producer Kat, sent the schedule of what our lives were going to be for the next couple of months, whether it's writing, outlining, researching, writing top of show, being fresh eyes, doing jokes. She sent this very elaborate schedule that dictated all of our lives, and I like collapsed on the floor because six people was not enough to do this job. And I think Caitlin and I were supposed to like do a thing, like go to a movie or have dinner. And I got this email, and she's like, "Is everything okay?" And I'm face down on the floor, like, "Yes, everything's fine. I don't think I can eat. There's no room in the schedule for it. I think I just need to be here."
Yeah. And like that's so with mini rooms, there's also the expectation is that you're going to make 16 episodes or whatever. And then those aren't even going to be the first season. You're going to have season 1A and 1B, which means it's dividing it between two seasons essentially, especially for streaming. And then you're like, you don't know if you have a job for the next 2 years because now they've got enough episodes for two seasons. And they're not backing those up. They're just like waiting to see how they do. And then they'll be like, maybe we'll do another episode. I mean, another season. And if you get back on a show, you no guarantee that like you're going to be back for it because it's 2 years later or whatever. And if you have, let's say like you have a live action show where you have a child or children actors in the show, they're fucking, they're like adults now. They're like 2 years older. And so then you got to write around that. And so it's just, it seems like an untenable thing. And, I hear about people on the lines talking about it, and I'm just like, you can't live that way. And the job security, there's just nothing.
And it's crazy and absurd. I mean, we this podcast isn't about writing; it's about bow ties. So we don't want to spend too much time talking about writing and the strike or anything like that. But it's crazy to me coming from where we came from that we were both working for a comedy website that was under the larger umbrella of a Silicon Valley, Silicon Beach tech startup, where it's a whole bunch of goobers with too much money who don't understand things, who are trying to tell writers and website developers how to do their thing better and faster. And like, wouldn't it be cool if we could disrupt web, if we could disrupt social media, if we could disrupt this? And just like, I think I'm a fucking idiot with too much money. I think we could do it faster and cheaper. And now it seems like all of those goobers are running television.
Yeah.
Which is we were both so happy to be free from web and to work with showrunners and writers and directors and producers. But now it seems like at the top of all of our chains is some rich goober who owns a retail company that also makes Lord of the Rings, or some rich goober that owns a phone company that also makes Ted Lasso. It's these people at the top of the chain who are like, do we actually need writers, or could we just like get three buddies in a room for a week to just go make a Game of Thrones? You've seen Game of Thrones. Make another one. Do it. Do it in 3 weeks.
We'll push them hard, but like that's, you got to be scrappy, man. Yeah. You got to be scrappy. That's how you survive. And like, that's also like, Apple's not going to be content with just having like, hey, we've got a pretty good streaming model now. Seems to be doing all right. That's not how like it works. They're going to be like, we got to see growth every single year. There's got to be growth or we kill it.
The headlines for the last 10 years or so that have been like, every streaming network is trying to find the next Game of Thrones. It's like, oh, every streaming network is trying to find a wildly successful show that was based on a book that took decades of time to write and produce and get right. Sure. I mean, that makes sense. You're not going to do it this summer. It takes time.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Well, thank you for letting me vent about that, Daniel.
No, that's okay. I didn't even think I was going to vent, but I mean, we got to, you and I got to protest together yesterday for the first time.
That's great.
Because I'm out in LA for reasons that I can no longer remember. And we got to march around Sony and talk to other writers. And it's, like I've said before on this podcast, inspiring to be around other writers who are protesting, and also incredibly demoralizing. And, you know, we all want to just fucking get back to work. And that's the thing that I think about when I've got my foot in a boot because it's broken, and your wrist is in a cast because it's broken, and we're marching around carrying signs and like raising our fists when cars drive by and honk to support us. It's like, yeah, this is good, but also just like, please let us get back to work. I never thought I would be a person who is like begging to go back to work, but I really want to. I want to write, and the studios won't fucking let us right now, so they force us to march around you and I, these hobbled heroes.
I was talking to my mom on the phone, and she was like, how's the strike going? I'm like, you know, it's okay. It's we're out there every day. And she was like, so are you getting paid at all during it? And I was like, no.
Yeah.
No, I don't have a job. And she's like, well, do you think that your job would be in jeopardy by this? Do you think your show might go away? And I was like, yeah, very easily. And she was like, but you had a great job. And I was like, yeah. Oh, this strike's not for me personally. Like, this, I'm on the strike. Things are bad for most writers. I'm on a very lucky show. And the point is that we have to make it hurt all the way around. Like, I'm leaving this for the sake of everybody else, because that's what they did to get me my job. Like, my job is great because other writers did this.
Yeah.
And like, that's just part of it. And she was like, oh, I didn't realize you weren't getting paid.
I think that is worth pointing out to our listeners, because someone asked me that too. Like, cause I'm back in LA, and so I'm letting all of my LA friends know that I'm around and available. And they're like, oh, I'm sorry you broke your foot on vacation. Like, not vacation. I am functionally unemployed right now. I'm not getting paid. All of the writers on strike, even if we seem happy in pictures on Instagram or Twitter, we're all not getting paid. We're all unemployed at the moment.
Yeah. And that's just the risk we're taking. That's important.
It is.
All right. Well, you can follow Daniel on Twitter at @DOB_Inc. You can follow me, Soren, at Soren_LTD. You can follow our show at Quick Question. No, you can't. You can follow our show, Quick Question, at @QQ_SorenandDan. We have an email, which is QQ@SorenandDaniel@gmail.com. We've got a producer, sound engineer, editor, and all around great guy, and Gabe Harder. Still a great website, GabeHarder.com. I encourage you to go visit it. Just see, I think maybe, if I remember correctly, there's a flash animation of maybe some construction work being done.
Mm-hmm.
We have a Patreon.
Flash is generous. I think it is just a single image.
We have a Patreon at patreon.com/quickquestion, or you could just search it on Patreon if you wanted to. And our theme song is by Me Rex, a really great theme song. I listened to it the other day, because I listened to the episode that I wasn't on with you and Michael and Abe, and I was like, oh shit, our theme song rules. So you can find more of Me Rex's music on Spotify or on Apple, on iTunes. You can also find them at merex.bandcamp.com.
Exciting news pretty soon. We don't know when yet, but we will be doing video versions of the podcast where Soren and I, you can see our mouths and bodies moving as we talk. And that's going to be on YouTube, youtube.com/QQ podcast.
Yeah, you'll still be able to listen to these episodes the way you usually listen to podcasts. But if you were interested in watching it as a video instead, we've already started filming them, so you could see those soon.
God, that's a lot of fucking shit that we talk about at the end. That's a lot of like plugs and stuff.
I know. You know, we might want to lead with the video stuff next time, because I think people just, if I was listening to this podcast, I would, as soon as we were like, well, let's wrap it up, I'd be like, all right, fucking let's go to the next
one. Yeah, 100%.
All right, well, thanks for, I was just going to say bye.
Bye. I'm just
What's your favorite? How did you get? What would I be? Remember? What's it all do? Where did all go? Why do we know? Oh, forget it. Soren, Mooney, Daniel O'Brien. Two best friends and comedy writers. If there's an answer, they're gonna find it. I think you'll have a great time here. I think you'll have a great time here.